best three posters will get awards, and the first authors have some 10 minutes to present their work here. And actually the first one, Best Abstract Award goes to Nicole Fenton. Nicole Fenton is a third year doctoral student in the clinical psychology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Nicole, she...
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Yes. Great. Thank you. All right, great. Well, today I'll be talking about how resilience factors influence adjustment in adolescents with chronic kidney disease. As you can see, I had multiple collaborators with me on this project, and I want to especially acknowledge Dr. Maria Ferris, who was definitely key in helping me to complete this project. I'll begin by discussing how adolescents are able to adjust while having this chronic kidney disease. Multiple studies have shown us that illness severity alone does not predict adjustment within this chronic illness population. This leads us to think that maybe psychosocial factors are playing a role. After reviewing the literature, two key psychosocial factors emerged as central when conceptualizing what may predict adjustment within this chronic illness population: family functioning and coping efficacy. There are many reasons to consider the adolescent within the family functioning context. Adolescents rarely come unaccompanied to medical visits and generally rely on their family to provide medical care. Additionally, studies have shown that family functioning is central when predicting both the short and long-term course of an adolescent's adjustment. Thus, family functioning becomes central when understanding the environmental influence within this adolescent's context. The key individual factor, on the other hand, is coping efficacy. Imagining adolescents' daily lives while living with chronic kidney disease, we can imagine that they have frequent doctor's visits, epigen shots, have to take many medications, and thus must use their coping strategies more frequently than their healthy peers. So thinking about how these environmental influences of family functioning and individual influence of coping efficacy leads to adjustment brings me to my current studies model. The majority of the research to date has focused on how risk factors, specifically a diagnosis of this chronic illness, leads to maladjustment. However, I was much more interested in how resilience factors would lead to positive adjustment, specifically looking at how positive family functioning and positive coping efficacy could lead to adjustment. Adjustment has been defined in three different ways within my current study: social functioning, mental functioning, and specifically depressive symptoms, and then physical functioning, specifically medication non-adherence and emergency healthcare use. So thinking about how these two resilience factors, the adolescent can overcome the risk factor of having this chronic illness and lead to positive adjustment, led to the following hypotheses: that adolescents living in the context of high family functioning and high overall coping efficacy, they would be able to develop positive high levels of social functioning and low levels of depressive symptoms. The reason I was interested in looking at coping efficacy specifically was that it allows us to understand not only the frequency with which these adolescents are using their various coping strategies, but also how efficacious these coping strategies are when dealing with various stressors associated with their illness. Thinking about coping efficacy, it may be important when predicting social functioning as well as depressive symptoms, and when beginning to understand physical outcomes. Studies have shown us that coping efficacy is a key predictor of emergency healthcare use. However, it may be that medication non-adherence is in fact explaining the relationship between coping efficacy and emergency healthcare use, such that if adolescents have high levels of coping efficacy, they'll take their medications as prescribed and thus avoid ending up in the emergency room. So these were my three hypotheses. And I'm going to go over a little bit of the demographics of who we recruited. Overall, we had a very high recruitment rate. Approximately 88% of participants agreed to participate. And on average, our sample was 15 years old. As you can see, the sample was predominantly African-American males coming from a single-parent household and holding public insurance. In terms of disease demographics, the sample was predominantly holding glomerular CKD and had CKD stages 2 through 4. So this was the demographics of who we recruited. The study was implemented by through UNC's Pediatric Kidney Outpatient Clinic. Anyone within the age range of 13 to 18 was eligible to participate as long as they had CKD stages 2 to 5. All measures were administered through a web-based program known as Qualtrics, and all measures used were extremely well-validated and consistently used in the chronic illness literature. So what did we find? First, let me give you a bit of an overview of kind of what our findings were. Overall, we see that we had actually a very well-adjusted, healthy sample. These kids had overall very positive family functioning. They were coping well with their illness and, in fact, needed prompting to think of a stressor associated with their illness. They had positive social functioning comparable to other chronic illness populations, very low depressive symptoms, and on average reported taking their medications. Very few reported missing them. So we see that this is a pretty healthy, well-adjusted sample. So how did that influence our hypotheses? So hypothesis one, remember, was that higher levels of family functioning would predict better social functioning and less depressive symptoms. So really the key take-home message of what we found here was that within these families, adolescents can have varying levels of conflict. They can have varying levels of expressiveness or amount of emotion that's expressed, as long as they really have this sense of cohesion in their families, this sense of unity, this sense of togetherness, this sense of support within their families. And if they have that, we saw that they, in fact, had better social functioning. This has a lot of clinical implications for us as healthcare providers in that it suggests if we're working with a family and really not seeing this sense of unity and support, we should try to facilitate it whenever possible. And that it's really important for the adolescent to have that support within their families to develop these healthy peer relationships. In terms of our second hypothesis, we found that two key coping strategies were really important when predicting this social functioning. Remember, our overall hypothesis would higher coping efficacy predict better social functioning and less depressive symptoms. And we, in fact, found that these two coping strategies of the efficacy of emotion regulation and efficacy of social support were key predictors of social functioning. So this is really saying, can adolescents regulate their emotion when going through all these stressors? Can they regulate how they react? Can they regulate if they react positively or negatively? And if they can, they're more likely to have positive social functioning. In terms of the second part here, the efficacy of social support, this is saying as they're going through all these stressors, do they seek out peer relationships? Do they seek out family members, friends? And if they do, they're more likely, again, to have positive social functioning. In terms of my third hypothesis, it was that medication non-adherence would mediate or explain the relationship between coping efficacy and emergency healthcare use. So what we found was that, in fact, one of the specific coping strategies really explained this relationship. So the coping efficacy of resignation, so this sense of hopelessness, this sense of helplessness, would predict adolescents not taking their medications, and in turn would predict then them ending up in the emergency room. This, again, has really important clinical implications and would be an important board's question if it was there. So really this is saying that if we as healthcare providers see that our adolescents really have this sense of hopelessness, helplessness, lack of control, we should try to facilitate that whenever possible. Kind of a simple example might be not asking, do you want to take an Epogen shot, but when do you want to take it? Do you want to take it Sunday or Monday? So giving them choices whenever possible. And if doing that, hopefully we can decrease their resignation and increase the amount of time that they do take their medications and avoid them ending up in the emergency room. So overall, we really saw that this was in fact a healthy, well-adjusted sample of kids with chronic kidney disease. We saw a few depressive symptoms, high levels of family functioning. We saw that really this family factor of cohesion, the sense of unity, is important when trying to understand adolescent social functioning. And if there is this sense of cohesion and unity within the family context, adolescents are more likely to have these positive peer relationships. We saw that the efficacy of emotion regulation and seeking support were two really good strategies for adolescents when, again, trying to predict positive social functioning. And if we as healthcare providers see that our adolescents really have this sense of resignation and no personal control over their illness, we should try and facilitate that whenever possible because it really is important in understanding whether they're going to take their medications and whether they'll end up in the emergency room or not. So overall, I think this study presents a pretty positive picture in that it's really saying that if adolescents have this positive medical care, and we pair that with this sense of family support and a sense of control for the adolescent themselves, they'll end up doing pretty well while managing this chronic illness. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think there is time for one question, if there is. The second MOD for the best abstract is Manfred Heking. Manfred Heking is trainee in nephrology from the Medical University in Vienna, currently working on sodium with Fritz Port and colleagues at Ann Arbor Research Collaborative for Health. In the current presentation, he will present data from a recent study on sodium performed in his home unit in Vienna. Manfred Heking holds research grant from the Else Gröner Fresenius Foundation in Germany.
Danke. Danke sehr. So thank you very much for this wonderful award and the chance to present my data at this great conference. I'm going to talk about sodium set point and sodium gradient, its influence on plasma sodium change and weight gain. I've chosen a characteristic picture that I will refer to a little later. And I have a very brief introduction since we've heard a lot on sodium already. So it's good if you're a trainee in nephrology to get simple messages. And advising dialysis patients to restrict fluid intake without restricting sodium intake is not based on evidence and a waste of time, has been written by Charles Thompson in 2001, as there was evidence that you could simply restrict fluid intake by reducing sodium intake. And salt may be perceived as a neglected silent killer. Salt is a potential uremic toxin, as we've heard from one of our previous speakers, Professor Ritz. And the keynote address in this conference was whether salt may be a wolf in sheep's clothing. So the aim of my current study, going back to the cartoon, you see two men that are walking through the desert, but one of them has eaten potato chips, and he thinks that he shouldn't have done that, at least not during the last mile, because the potato chips, by containing a lot of salt, have increased his serum sodium concentration, and as he's not able to drink water, he can experience the difficulties. The difficulties are thirst, and you can imagine what it feels like for dialysis patients to have thirst, as you all know that. So in a bit more scientific terms, this paper has also been presented at this conference already. Keen and Gotch have shown that there is an association between the sodium set point to interdiabetic weight gain, blood pressure in hemodialysis patients, and they've actually identified the gradient as the difference between the prescribed serum sodium minus the pre-dialysis serum sodium, and they've showed an association with interdialytic weight gain. So in our study, we aim to analyze the relationship between the set point, the gradient, as Keen and Gotch did, but also the change in serum sodium and HD-related variables. Considering that Keen and Gotch have analyzed a study in about 50 patients, they've had a relatively high dialysate sodium composition of 143. In our unit, we had a different one, as I will show you. And especially, they didn't gather data on the delta, so on the pre to post dialysis serum sodium change. Our methods, this was an observational cohort study, IRB approved in Vienna. We had 132 patients. We studied a 4-week period and had 12 treatment sessions per patient recorded. We dialyzed with Fresenius and Nikiso machines, half to half. Sodium measurements were performed using direct potentiometry, radiometer medical. This is typically a point of care device that is not used in the centralized labs. This has also been an issue of discussion previously from the talk of Professor Oberleitner. However, the measurements are supposed to reflect very closely the indirect sodium measurements, as the the IFCC, so the International Federation of Clinical Chemists, is sort of overlooking the sodium values and is making sure that worldwide we really have only one sodium value available. However, there is a problem with sodium values, as you have heard. And just two formulas that I want to show here. The sodium gradient was calculated as the prescribed dialysis sodium minus the pre-dialysis sodium concentration. The delta serum sodium change is the post-dialysis minus the measured pre-dialysis, and interdialytic weight gain, of course, is calculated by subtracting the post-dialysis weight of the last session from the pre-dialysis weight of the next session. So what are the results? I'm showing you five slides here. First of all, the distribution of serum sodium, dialysis sodium, the gradient, and the delta. We can see at the left-hand corner that the sodium set point, as calculated by averaging 12 dialysis sessions that we recorded in these patients, is more or less normally distributed with a mean of 138. And the dialysate sodium composition in our unit was obviously not normally distributed, as most patients were receiving a dialysate sodium composition of 138. So we cannot say really that our patients have been individualized, but they've been lower in comparison to Keen and Gotch, who used 143. So that's the prescribed dialysate sodium. And the gradient as it was calculated, now it sort of takes up an almost normal distribution again as you subtract the set point from the prescribed DNA. And the delta sodium change, as measured between post and pre, and subtracting pre from post-dialysis, was again normally distributed. So correlations showed that the delta serum sodium change and the gradient were nicely correlated with a Pearson correlation of coefficient of 0.76, statistically significant. Relative interdialytic weight gain and gradient were correlated in our analysis as well, not as highly as in Keen and Gotch's analysis, possibly because we were using lower serum sodium baths. But the relative interdialytic weight gain and the delta serum sodium change was correlated a bit better with an R of 0.44, and we didn't see any correlation between systolic blood pressure and delta SNA. So I'm going to spare a lot of tables which were used to identify factors that might influence both interdialytic weight gain and delta sodium change. I'm going to go straight to the multiple logistic regression analysis, where we are showing that higher interdialytic weight gain is basically predicted by delta SNA in younger age. So younger age is not modifiable, as you know. Delta SNA may be modifiable. So the next question is, what are the predictors of delta SNA? And the delta SNA, bigger than 0 millimoles per liter, so a positive serum sodium balance pre to post dialysis in a multiple regression analysis was predicted by the serum sodium set point, obviously, because if you have a lower serum sodium to begin with, you get a higher delta SNA if you prescribe the same dialysate, unless you really individualize the dialysate sodium composition. But it was also predicted by the dialysate sodium baths, the ones that were prescribed. It was again predicted by younger age, but it was also predicted by sodium profiling and by the use, interestingly, of Nikkiso machines. So dialysis machines were considerably off, as we've already heard from a previous speaker 2 days ago. We could see that in the left corner, you see here the difference between prescribed and measured dialysis bath, and you can see that very few machines are really delivering what you've prescribed. And to give you an impression of how much they differ, on the right side of the graph, you can see the difference. And you have two peaks, one at the right side and one at the left side. That means the machines are off. However, on average, the machines that we measured did not differ from the prescribed. So on average, they were pretty good, with a 0.01, a standard deviation of 2.5. So standard deviation was high, but on average, everything that was prescribed was delivered, at least in our unit. So the question is, which dialysis machines are delivering higher and lower? We did a simple chi-square test and graded the sodium difference smaller than 2 milliequivalents per liter versus bigger than 2 milliequivalents per liter. A very simple chi-square analysis, not even fooling around with the data, just once and clinical considerations for bigger than 2 and smaller than 2. And boom, we got Fresenius in the left corner and Nikkiso in the right. So that was consistent with the previous results from the multiple regression analysis. And one more thing that we did, we looked at the correlation between the GNA versus the delta SNA just by machine type. I've shown you previously that the correlation was nice with an R of 0.7. And now if you look at those patients that were dialyzed mostly or bigger than 10 treatments with Nikkiso machines in our units, they sometimes switch, but we used bigger than 10 as a number. And if you looked at the Fresenius machines, so patients being dialyzed with Fresenius machines, interestingly, the intercept between gradient and delta SNA was positive for the Nikkiso machines and slightly negative for the Fresenius machines. And this indicates that you're thinking of applying a gradient of zero in my unit with a Nikkiso machine, but you actually were applying a positive gradient. And you were thinking to be applying a gradient of zero with a Fresenius machine, but you were actually applying a negative gradient in my unit. We can discuss this briefly. That it's the problem seems to be is that the conductivity adjustments in the Nikkiso machine, they have to be manually adjusted to the bicarb. So if you rise or lower the bicarb, you have to manually adjust the serum sodium conductivity, and most nurses don't know that. And actually, I think that our nurses are quite well trained, and some of them seem to know this better than others. And the table that is distributed by Nikiso is very small, and this became a big issue at my unit, so we've now solved this problem. But whether or not you may have similar experiences, this would be interesting to discuss. So in conclusion of this part of the talk, interdialytic weight gain correlates with the sodium gradient, but more strongly with delta serum sodium. Higher delta serum sodium is associated with pre-dialysis serum sodium concentration, the set point, the dialysis sodium prescription, Nikiso dialysis machine, sodium profiling in younger age. And hard endpoints, morbidity and mortality of the serum sodium set point, but in relationship with the DNA prescription, should be further studied. In order to study this further, I got into a collaboration with Fritz Port and colleagues from the Arbor Research Collaborative for Health. And I'm going to show you just in one slide what we've seen there in DOPS, namely predictors of mean serum sodium. Now we've got a bigger N, obviously, than in my unit in Vienna. So we've got an N of 11,340 patients. That's nice if you have that. And we've just, in this data set, I'm going to show you what predicts a higher and a lower serum sodium. So age is predicting a higher serum sodium. Male gender is predicting a higher serum sodium. Black race is vintage. BMI, and you have to look at the estimates. If they are higher, then it's clinically meaningful. If they are lower, then it's not very meaningful, obviously. So what I wanted to stress here is that interdialytic weight gain per percent lost is predicting a negative serum sodium set point. That sort of makes sense. So if patients are gaining a lot of weight, then they may dilute their sodium. So the question from this data set in DOPS now is, again, a very old chicken or egg question. And please stay in touch for the answer as to understanding why this interdialytic weight gain delta SNAS association. Is it really just from the sodium that you're infusing into the patient and he's gaining more weight because of that, because he's thirsty? Or may it be related to the sodium set point itself, because that's related to interdialytic weight gain? And it's probably both. So acknowledgements, my boss in Vienna is, the big boss is Professor Hurl, but the person that I work with on this subject is Professor Sundar Plasman, who's a very good advisor in this field and also, well known in the field of Fabry research. And I'm very grateful to Professor Port, obviously, and the colleagues at Arbor Research Collaborative for Health, Rajiv Saran and Ananda Sen from the University of Michigan. Thank you for your attention.
I'm afraid for the interest of time now, it's maybe we want to postpone questions.
Sorry, yeah.
Of the talk.
Okay. This is that.
Okay, and the third award for the best poster goes to Meredith Seaman. She completed her residency training in general pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin in medicine in 2009. She's currently a second young pediatric nephrology fellow at the Children's Hospital in Boston, working in the lab of Valerie Schumacher.
Thank you very much. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak to all of you this morning. Okay. Multiple clinical entities are associated with irreversible renal scarring underlying eventual chronic kidney disease. As you well know, one important and highly complex cell type, the podocyte, is essential for maintenance of an intact glomerular filtration barrier. Adherence of its foot processes to the glomerular basement membrane is dependent on several key structural proteins, including alpha-3, beta-1 integrin, and actin. And as you know, foot processes are dynamic structures, most likely related to the actin remodeling that occurs. And this can take place under normal physiological conditions or when the podocyte is exposed to a stress. But as you know, when podocytes experience a sustained insult, foot process effacement occurs, as seen in panel B there at the EM level. And this is most likely related to alterations in the actin cytoskeleton. Now, there could be two mechanisms involved for this actin remodeling to occur. The first being transport of the protein itself to the periphery, or the cell can have local translational control if the mRNA corresponding to the necessary protein is available for the cell in the periphery. Our interest in the second mechanism led to our research hypothesis that it is beneficial for podocytes to have important mRNAs encoding key cytoskeletal elements available for protein synthesis in the periphery in order to maintain complex foot process architecture and ultimately prevent the changes that underlie chronic kidney disease. In order to study mRNA localization, in situ hybridization was performed on cultured podocytes from an immortalized murine cell line that was established in our lab. These cells can differentiate at 37 degrees Celsius and form extensions. Although this is an imperfect model, this can mimic foot processes in vivo. Now, as one mRNA known to localize in neurons, another polarized cell type, to their axons and dendrites is beta-actin mRNA, we were interested in examining this as a potential candidate mRNA. And as you can see in the top panel there, although there is localization of beta-actin mRNA in the perinuclear region, it is also localized to the cell's leading edge in a polarized fashion. Now, for these experiments, the bottom panel represents the sense probe, which served as a control, and as you can see, gives no signal. Now, if this were related to diffusion alone, one would expect that all foot process extensions would have a similar localization pattern. I have also examined other candidate mRNAs, including histone, which was found not to localize. And this slide here is just to demonstrate that another key mRNA for cytoskeletal integrity, alpha-actinin 4 mRNA, also localizes to podocyte cell extensions in vitro. Now, for an in vivo model, I have established a protocol in our lab that is now published by the group Herpers et al. And has been previously studied in Drosophila oocytes. And I've been optimizing this protocol for use with mouse kidney tissue. And although technically challenging, I've been able to produce some promising results at this point. So in brief, in the top right corner, you can see a nickel grid, and this is coated with an ultra-thin frozen section of mouse kidney tissue. And this tissue is then placed in inverted caps of Eppendorf tubes and then put into a humidified chamber for the in situ hybridization overnight. And this consists of application of a DIG-labeled probe overnight, and then on day number two, following washing and blocking steps, an anti-DIG antibody is applied, followed by an anti-sheep gold antibody, ultimately to detect the intrinsic mRNA in the tissue. And our results indicate that indeed beta-actin mRNA is localized to podocyte foot processes in vivo, shown by the arrow there. Similarly, alpha-actinin 4 mRNA is also present in podocyte foot processes, but can be seen in the podocyte cell body as well. Having demonstrated that beta-actin and alpha-actinin 4 mRNA localize to foot process extensions, both in vitro and in vivo, we are interested in examining the mechanisms that may be involved in local translational control. Specifically, are ribosomes recruited to the site where mRNA is present? And if recruitment occurs, what the mechanism may be? Our lab has shown at the EM level that ribosomes, indicated by the arrow there, are present in podocyte foot processes. But as just stated, it is not known if recruitment does occur. In order, one potential mechanism that could be involved in ribosomal recruitment could be through integrin signaling related to mechanical tension. In order to examine this, magnetic beads were coated with either an activating or blocking beta-1 integrin antibody. When applied to the cell, and specifically when bound to the integrin receptor, which is indicated by the little rectangles underneath the bead there, with addition of a mechanical force, integrin signaling can be activated within the cell and perhaps lead to ribosomal recruitment. These magnetic beads were applied to cultured podocytes for 1 hour, followed by alignment of the magnetic dipoles of the beads themselves in this chamber here. And then a mechanical force was applied for a specific time period at a set force in this magnetic chamber indicated here. Now, prior to the twisting experiment itself, in the far right-hand panel, I confirmed binding of the integrin antibodies with a secondary antibody directed against them, and staining for these experiments was for the large subunit of the ribosome, or L7A. And as you can see in the top panel, that after addition of an activating beta-1 integrin-coated antibody bead, in the second panel there, there is evidence of ribosomal recruitment around the site of the bead. Conversely, with application of blocking beta-1 integrin-coated beads, there is no ribosomal recruitment evident. And this was further quantified by counting the number of total beads that had labeling. And as you can see in the lower part of the graph, approximately 25% of the activating beta-1 integrin-coated beads produced a signal compared to less than 1% of the blocking beads. And that this was with over twice as many cells and beads counted. So in summary, these data suggest that integrin activation may be involved in ribosomal recruitment and local translational control. So in conclusion, we have demonstrated that beta-actin and alpha-actinin-4 mRNA localized to podocyte foot process extensions both in vitro and in vivo, and that mechanical tension in beta-1 integrin activation can result in recruitment of ribosomes. Therefore, in podocytes, mRNA transport and local translation may be important cellular tools for maintaining foot process architecture. Conversely, dysregulation of these mechanisms may result in the cytoskeletal anomalies that underlie the changes associated with chronic kidney disease. And we propose that an understanding of these mechanisms involved in structural integrity and repair could in the future facilitate directed therapies toward prevention of chronic kidney disease. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and also acknowledge the following people. First and foremost, my mentor in the lab, Valerie Schumacher, as well as the other members of the Schumacher and Creedberg labs in the Division of Nephrology, Donald Ingber and Martin Zavala for the use of their magnet for the twisting experiments, and Maria Erickson was instrumental at the EM facility at Harvard Medical School for our in vivo model. And lastly, the NephCure Foundation and March of Dimes Foundations for their funding support. And the picture is just to demonstrate that when one is studying RNA granules, one tends to think they're present everywhere, even when one's walking along the streets of Boston in the winter. Thank you very much.